Well, today in our Great Questions series, we come to one of the best ever Bible stories that everybody knows and everybody loves. And embedded in that great Bible story is a great question. And so today, looking at Daniel chapter 6 and the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Here's the story, if you don't remember it in detail. This is the end. The king set his heart on Daniel. He labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men said to the king, "Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establishes may be changed." And they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. And the king arose very early in the morning, and he went in haste to the den of lions. And he cried with a lamentable voice to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God whom you serve continually able to deliver you from the lions?" That's our question. Is your God able to deliver you from the den of lions? It's a great question. You know, your God. Is your God able to deliver you from your den of lions? Oh, Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God whom you serve continually able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, "My God has sent his angel and has shut the lions' mouths so they have not hurt me." So there it is. What a great idea. All right, so here's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about the lions that are around us, because there are a whole lot of lions around you and me as well, right? And then we're going to talk about every other God besides our God being completely unable to deliver us from the lions that threaten us. And you have choices. You know, what are you going to trust in? What God are you going to believe in? And we're going to throw that around a little bit. And then last of all, our God, our true God, is always able to rescue those who continually follow him and does indeed do it. Is your God able? And the answer is yes, he is. And that's where we're going today. I actually came across an account of a guy who was present during a tiger attack. This is a man's autobiography from 1857. So imagine, you know, we're going back a little ways in time here. There were no repeater rifles, that sort of thing. And so here we are, and he's going along, and he's with a big group. And it's 11 o'clock at night. He says, as they're walking along, at 11 o'clock at night, everything's very dark. And the guy who's in the front of the group suddenly was seized upon by a lion that came charging out from the bush, grabbed this guy in his powerful teeth and ran off into the woods. And they could hear in that moment, and it only took a moment, the tiger was biting him so hard it was breaking his bones. And the guy cried out, and he said instinctively, all of the rest of the party dropped down on the ground like babies, and they were covering their heads. And they were thinking that they were going to be next. And here's the way he said, "I found myself and companions lying down on the ground as if prepared to be devoured by our enemy, the sovereign of the forest." And they lay there for a moment and realized that the tiger wasn't coming back. And they crawled a long way in the dark. And then they all stood up and they just ran for like a half hour. And they were afraid to death because this beast was so powerful and they were so outmatched. So, you know, it's one thing to read the story of Daniel in the lion's den and think, yeah, we know how it goes. It's all good. And the lions are just like big house cats and you can pat them on the side of the head. It's like, no, this was a really, really big deal. And so are the hardships that you go through. Life is scary. Life is hard. This world is hard. And there are times when you could easily drop to a fetal position and think, oh, no, what's going to happen to me? So the question really matters. Is your God able to deliver you from that thing that you're afraid of? And the story counts, because that's a good question. There are many lions around us. I just wanted to remind you of some of these because it's not theoretical, not really. You know, if you're going to follow Jesus, if you're going to be a Christian, you're living in a kind of a bad generation for that. It would have been much easier for you if you had, you know, died about now instead of being alive about now, because there's a lot of harassment. There's a lot of pressure on us who are Christians. Rex Murphy was commenting on the anti-Christian sentiment that's all around us. And he said, to be a serious Christian in modern Western culture is to be favored as an easy target to this society. Christians are under a constant hail of abuse and disregard. And sometimes this really confuses us. We wonder, for example, why is the violence of Islam given a free pass in the media and the academic world? And yet, if Christians ever do anything wrong, they are just belittled and in every way hated. And, you know, why does one get a free pass and one doesn't? And it's just everywhere, so it's not like it's not obvious. We can all see it, and we ask ourselves why. Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. In your current generation, we have these terms that are happening right now. Postmodernism basically says that there's no such thing as objective truth. And so when Christians come along and say, you know, you really can't do that, that's wrong, well, that's not appreciated, because that's objective truth, and we don't want anybody coming around here and saying what you do is wrong. And so Christians are stuck with objective truth, but we live in a society where objective truth is hated. So we're kind of stuck. Critical theory, you know what that is? You run into it all the time now, but a few years ago it was no big deal. Critical theory basically says that all of America and all of the world is divided into tribes. And there can be, like, the white people tribe and the black people tribe and the gay tribe and the trans tribe. And there can be a Christian tribe and an Eastern tribe. And so everybody has a tribe. And in critical theory, you can't get away from that. You are from a tribe. And the thing is, in critical theory, all tribes are either oppressor tribes, dominant, or oppressed tribes. If they're oppressed tribes, then they might not necessarily be physically assaulted, but the ideas of the dominant tribe offend them continuously. And what's really weird is, no matter where you are in this tribalism, tribes fight. They always do. And so if you're from an oppressor tribe, and in critical theory, the key oppressor tribes are the American tribe over the rest of the world, the white tribe over all other races, that's racism, the tribe of heterosexuality, a man marrying a woman, that tribe, the cisgendered tribe, cis in Latin means same, that's the opposite of trans, which means different, cis tribe, that means you were born a male and you like to live as a male. Or you were born female and you like to live as a female. And if you're in that tribe, you're an oppressor to everybody who's born a male but wants to live like a female. In feminism, that's not convenient, because they were trying to say there's no such thing as living like a female or living like a male. They all live the same. But in critical theory, feminism, well, that's a tribe. And so they have their ideas, and sometimes those ideas are oppressive. And so tribes exist, and there's nothing you can do to that. As a matter of fact, if you are part of the oppressor tribes, then you cannot understand. It is impossible for you to understand what oppressed people feel. So every time you open your mouth to say, well, the reason we are cisgendered or the reason that we are heterosexual, every time you open your mouth, you are showing your ignorance that you don't understand what it's like to be oppressed. And you're only thinly veiling your attempt to keep your tribe as an oppressor tribe. And you are not only ignorant, you are unrelatable. So it really doesn't matter what you say. That's tribalism. That's critical theory. Well, obviously, if you happen to be me, I am the embodiment of everything that critical theory is trying to correct. Then there's cis normativity or heteronormativity. Cis heteronormativity means you're trying to normalize that a person who is born a male and wants to live as a male and marry as a male to a female, hetero, you're trying to say that's normative. You're trying to make that normal. We don't want that to be normal. And the fact that you're trying to make that normal means you're an oppressor. And you are belittling my ideas, which are to the contrary. And we have to do away with that. And you know, this is why you keep asking, why does Islam get a free pass and the Christians don't? It's because the Christians are from the privileged oppressor tribe. And you can punch up at the bully. You're little. The bully is big. Christians are big. So you can punch up at the Christian because it's a bad tribe, an oppressor tribe. But it's never right for a Christian to criticize down because that's punching down. That's the bully, the oppressing tribe, punching down on the oppressed people. And you can't let that happen. So every time you see that, you keep saying, why? That's the reason. Which is why it's not convenient to be a Christian right now. I mean, we're kind of like in a den of lions around here. Well, then there are the normal things that threaten us. One out of every three of us are going to have cancer sometime in our lives. We're certainly going to be affected by the cancer that loved ones around us have. I mean, that's a lion that's devouring a lot of our friends, might devour us. Food allergies, one out of 13 of us now, school age, have food allergies. Like, well, what's going on? My food is attacking me. Autism is now one out of every 37 boys in America. Like, wow, well, I know 37 boys. That's a big deal. It affects me and sometimes affects us in a profound way. You know why people go on disability in the United States? The number one reason? Mental health problems. I mean, the lions are just all around us. So many things can go wrong in life. And what about what's happening in our families? Right now, 45.2% of adults don't have a spouse, a lifetime companion. Well, some of these are 18 years old, and we're kind of glad they don't have a spouse yet, you know? But for so many people, and that's a higher percentage than has ever existed in history. That's it. So it's like, well, there's a lot of loneliness around here, and that's pretty rough. One out of every three American children don't have a biological father at home. That's one out of every three. That's a bunch. And one out of every four only have one parent at home. So it's like, wow, there are a lot of lions around here. A lot of things can go wrong in life. And Kevin DeYoung says, most everyone I know feels frazzled and overwhelmed most of the time. And that's what the people in my church are like. That's what my friends around the country are like. That's what I'm like, frazzled and overwhelmed. So there's no question that there are a lot of lions around here. And all of us have to face these lions. And the question that we started with is really important. Is the God whom you serve continually able to deliver you from all of that? Because there's an awful lot of stress and pressure on us. Most of us feel like we're kind of hanging by a thread. Most of us feel like we're just surviving. You know, we're doing the best we can in adverse circumstances. So the question is a good question. Is the God whom you serve able to deliver you from all of this? And of course the answer is, yes, it is. Major Harold Kushner was in Vietnam as a POW. And he's talking about what happens when people lose hope. And he said when they were in the POW camp, there was the constant attempt to brainwash the young men who were captured with him. And so the idea was, if you will cooperate with us and you'll rat out the people who have intelligence that we want, and if you'll be retaught, you know, when we tell you America is bad and you kind of agree with that, then we're going to work with you. And if you'll help us, if you'll cooperate, we'll set you free. And Harold Kushner says there's this one particular fellow who had really believed that, and he was cooperating fully with the Viet Cong. And then as time passed, he gradually realized that his captors had lied to him. They had no intention of ever setting him free. And when the full realization of this took hold, he became a zombie. He refused to do all work. He rejected all offers of food and encouragement from his buddies, POWs. And he simply lay on his cot, sucking his thumb. And in a matter of weeks, he was dead. I find that interesting because that's exactly what that guy said when his travel party was attacked by a tiger in 1857. He says, we all dropped to the ground and we just covered our heads. And we thought this was the end. Now, this guy, he's not with real lions. I mean, he's in trouble as a POW for sure. But what did he do? He dropped to the ground and covered his head, so to speak. And a little while later, he just died. There was no hope. The lions in his world were so threatening that there was no longer any chance that he saw of escape. And so it can happen with real lions, and it can happen with metaphorical lions. And if you have enough metaphorical lions around you, it can break a guy down. So we really need to answer this question. Is the God whom you serve continually able to deliver you from things like this? And the answer is yes. First, we have to say this, though. Every God, except for one, will eventually fail to deliver his followers from the mouths of the lions. You have to have the right God. So when Darius peers over the pit and says, is your God, Daniel, whom you serve, is that God able to deliver you? That's really the question. How about your God? I don't think my Babylonian gods can do it. Could your God do it? And so we have to realize you have a lot of gods to choose from here. For example, if you choose paganism, that God is not going to be able to deliver you from the things that are really threatening you right now. And I won't belabor this, but last week we talked a little bit about paganism and how the religions around the world are very inadequate to bring happiness. We have people today who are attracted, for example, to Eastern religion. We ask them, well, would you like to go live in India since you love yoga, transcendental meditation, since you love all things India? Would you like to go live there? And by there, I mean the parts that have not been very affected by Western culture. Would you like to live there? Like, no, I don't think I want to go live there. Right. Well, the gods of pantheism didn't do real well for delivering the Indian nation from their hardships. And we can do that all around the world. So there's paganism. That's a possibility. There's money. Some people think, well, money is going to deliver me from the lions. That's what I really need. I just need more money. And if I could get that together, I think I'll be delivered from the lions. And sometimes it's romance. You know, as long as you have your one true love, a kindred spirit, as long as you have that, then you can survive the lions. It's all about the romance. And sometimes it's leisure. I just want to play, you know. I want to travel. I want to have toys. I just want to have some creature comforts and some free time, and then I'll be okay. You know, the lions won't be so bad then. Or sometimes it's career. And none of those things can do what you think they can do. The only way you're going to be able to be okay in a world of lions is if you follow Daniel's God, the true God. Remember the story of Jack Whitaker, which has become a cautionary tale to everybody all around America, because in 2002, he won more than $300 million in a lottery. He was especially attached to his granddaughter, who is 15 years old. And when he got the money and was posing for all the pictures and everything, having won the lottery, no one was more excited than his granddaughter. She thought it was just great. And he moved into this new place, and he built her a bedroom that looked like the I Dream of Jeannie bottle. You know what I'm talking about? And she just thought that was great. And he started giving her tons of money. He gave Brandy $2,000 a month, and she's 15, 16 years old. And sometimes he would just give her like $5,000. You know, he had endless money. It didn't matter. And so he just was being generous to his granddaughter, which is great. But also it sort of changed him. He started going to strip clubs, and he would treat the girls there with contempt. You know, he was so mean to them. And he was drinking too much and gambling too much. He was bragging one time to some people at one of the clubs that he had $500,000 out in his car. Well, naturally, somebody heard that, went and relieved him of $500,000 in one day. I mean, he was just out of control. And then Brandy had a boyfriend over one time after a year and a half of living this way. And the boyfriend ends up dead in Jack's house from an overdose of drugs that Brandy bought for him. You get to about 2 years, almost exactly 2 years into this fortune. Brandy herself died of a drug overdose. He won the lottery in the Christmas season of 2002. Brandy's funeral was in the Christmas season of 2004. shortly after Brandy's funeral, Jack's wife divorced him. And in the end, he said, I wish I had torn that ticket up. So if you think, well, it's the money, you know, it's all about the money. The money's going to be my rescuer from all the lions that are in this world. Money doesn't really do that. So you don't want to bank on money. Kurt and Marie were sort of like the model Christian couple. They volunteered to help with the teen ministry at their church. They were well-liked. They were great. But Marie was discontent in the marriage. She said, well, you know, Kurt, he's like an athlete. He's a big oaf. I really would like to have a little more sophistication in my life. And there was this guy who seemed to represent that at the gourmet grocery store. And they got to talking. And Kurt eventually looked in Marie's diary. And she kept track of every thought she had in that diary. And how she thought her husband was a big oaf. But this guy at the grocery store, he was a sophisticate. He liked the opera. He liked the symphony. He liked to read classic literature just like she did. And she, in that diary, schemed on how to win this fellow as her new romantic partner for the rest of her life. Well, that is the way it turned out. She left Kurt, and she took up with this new guy a whole new life. Well, eventually Kurt remarried and put together a nice life, and we're very glad for that. Meanwhile, Marie and this new husband immediately start to have strife in their new marriage, and it's all very upsetting. This man is emotionally unwell, and so after 2 years, Marie also divorces from this guy. She takes up with a new boyfriend. Her daughter, who lives with them, has bulimia, and she describes the relationship with the new boyfriend that her mom has like this. She said, it's basically two people sitting around drinking beer and yelling at each other. Well, that's romance. And you think, romance will do it, you know? If we can just have romance, then all the lions stay away. I mean, who cares about the lions when you're in love? But romance isn't what you think it is. Romance is only good if you have Daniel's God helping you with the lions. And romance is great. You know, I'm for romance. I think I'm kind of a sentimental slob. I can cry over anything. So I like romance. But romance is not like Daniel's God. You know, that's going to let you down. Angela Thomas is so good this way. She was a for real Christian. I mean, she really loved Jesus. And she had a real romance with her husband, but her husband dumped her cruelly. And she doesn't have any money. She goes back to live with her parents for 3 months. And she said, basically for 3 months, I just cried all the time. And she says, I lost 30 pounds on the divorce diet. And she was just a wreck. And it came time when she needed the money to move into her own place with her kids. And she had to sell her wedding ring set. So she goes to the jewelry store and she asks the jeweler about this. He says, she says, our eyes met. And I knew that he knew. He knew why I was there selling my wedding set. His countenance softened and I could feel the instant tears trickle down my face when he asked how he could help. He handed me a check for $1,400, shaking my hand and telling me ever so sincerely that he was sorry. It's like, well, romance is great, but sometimes romance is the lion. You know, that's what her husband was to her. You can't think that romance is the God who can deliver you from the lion's den. That's not going to work. Don't put your worship there. Is there anything more haunting, beautiful, but haunting than Fantine's song in Les Mis? Poor thing. She took up with a married guy who eventually cast her off. And this is that song. It's a beautiful song and a horrible song all at once. There was a time when love was blind and the world was a song and the song was exciting. There was a time then it all went wrong. And in light of the lion's den, is this not poignant? But the tigers come at night with their voices soft as thunder, and they tear your hope apart, and they turn your dream to shame. I had a dream my life would be so different from this hell I'm living. Now life has killed the dream I dreamed. I mean, romance is great, but you can't let romance be your God. It's just not going to hold up. Can the God whom you serve continually deliver you from the lions? And if romance is that God, that can't work out for you. People say it's all about the job. You know, it's all about the career. You have to, whatever it takes, you know. Jimmy Johnson of Dallas Cowboys coaching fame says, if your family doesn't like what you're doing, get a new family. That's what I did. All for career, right? But do you realize what the careers really are when somebody says, your career is going to give you fulfillment? What you got to do is quit worrying so much about church attendance and quit worrying so much about your family and quit worrying about other things that are, you know, fighting for your time and your priorities. You got to set all that aside. You got to put your effort into your career. But do you realize what careers are? These are the top 15 careers in America right now. This is what they're doing. By the way, all of this is honorable. I'm not dissing the careers, right? This is great. This is the Protestant Christian work ethic. Go for it and do a great job and give your employer value for his dollar. I'm for it. I'm not against it. But if you thought this was a God to deliver you from the lions, that just isn't going to work. Here's what people are trading Daniel's God for in many cases. Retail salespeople, cashiers, office clerks, food service workers, nurses, that's a little better. Waiters, waitresses, customer service representatives, material movers, you know, forklift, boxes, put it in the truck. Janitors, stockers, order fillers, Amazon, you know. Secretaries, bookkeepers, accounting clerks, run the numbers. General managers, I manage the restaurant. Truck drivers, school teachers, again, that's kind of good. But that's not God. I mean, all of that is great. It's great. But it's not God. It can't deliver you from the lions. I mean, if you wanted to derive meaning in your life, you're not going to get that from working the numbers behind a cubicle. I mean, there's a fraction of meaning in that. That's what you parlay into putting a roof over the heads of nice people that you love. See, the love part is what gives that a context of meaning. But it's not all by itself meaning. And you want to be awfully careful what you sacrifice for career. So Tim Keller says, in our lives, there are always some things that we invest in to get a level of joy and fulfillment that only God can give. The most painful times in our lives, I love this. The most painful times in our lives are times in which these idols are being threatened or removed. So I put so much into my job and now I got fired. Like, you're kidding, right? That was supposed to keep me from the lions and the job has become the lions. The most painful time in my life was when I thought I had a romance figured out and it was gone. The romance became the lion. The most painful time in your life is when you have set up a God that can't possibly deliver you. And when these idols are being threatened or removed, it crushes you. Life has killed the dream I dreamed. That's what happens. You have to have Daniel's God. So that's where we are. Daniel's God, our God, rescues those who continually follow him. And every word there is important. Not every God, the true God. If he's our God, and if we continually serve him, every word is important. If you serve him part-time, if you serve him halfway, that doesn't really count. Our God, if we continually serve him, always rescues us. And, you know, we're counting on that. So in our story, the king cried with a lamentable voice, "Oh, Daniel, is your God whom you serve continually able to deliver you from the lions?" And Daniel said, "My God has sent his angel, shut the lions' mouths, they have not hurt me." You think, all right, but what if the lions did eat him? Because it happens all the time. Then what would that mean? And I'm asking that because I know what it's like to be devoured. I know what it's like to lose. So I want to know what would have happened then. And we actually have an answer for that. Because that's what happened in Acts chapter 7 with Stephen. I mean, they weren't lions, but it's the same idea. Stephen is preaching to the Jewish people who only a few weeks earlier in Jerusalem had orchestrated the crucifixion of Christ. So he's a couple months after that time. And he's saying, you know, you were totally wrong in what you did. Well, the Jewish leaders aren't going to take that sitting down. And they were so upset with him that their teeth were chattering. You know, when you are so mad, when you are so incensed that your teeth chatter, you're pretty upset. Well, that's this. They were so mad at what Stephen was saying. When they heard these things, they were cut to the heart and they gnashed their teeth at him. But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, looked up steadfastly into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing on the right hand of God. Sometimes people call that the beatific vision. It means it's the vision you have when you see God and it is so amazing, so breathtaking, and so wonderful, you don't really care what else is happening in the world. You don't care if you're going to die, in Stephen's case. He had the beatific vision, like, this is the Savior here. And verse 59, those fellows stoned Stephen. They picked up stones, and they began to pelt him with stones. Some stones the size of a softball, you know, would hit you in the head, perhaps, knock you unconscious, and then they just pummel you with stones once you're down and you're dead. That's what happened. They stoned Stephen, calling upon God and saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. Say, you know, where's the fear? Where's the hate? Like, why aren't your teeth chattering because you're so angry, you're so hurt, you're so emotional? Why aren't your teeth chattering? Your teeth are fine. Why is this calm coming over your soul? Verse 60, he kneeled down and cried, Lord, do not lay this into their charge. And when he said this, he fell asleep. So what we wanted to know when we started this was, what if Daniel had been devoured by the lions? What if? We're reading over there in Luke chapter 16 that when this poor godly man named Lazarus died, he was escorted by angels to paradise. When Daniel was in the lion's den, the king said, so is the God whom you serve able to deliver you from the lions? He said, yeah, actually, God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths and no hurt came to me. So the question is, what happens if when the angel came, he did not shut the lion's mouth? What if when the angel came to Daniel in the lion's den, he held out his hand and said, come on, Daniel, it's time to go. And the lions snapped him in two. That's still a win. You know that's a win. That's why we can confidently say that Daniel's God always rescues those who follow him. And that's why you should follow him. I'm going to tell you the story of two sisters as we close today. Two sisters, one is named Star and one is named Mimosa. They live in India in the very early 1900s. The first time Star saw missionary Amy Carmichael, Amy was at a well with two other missionaries talking and smiling and talking to others. And Star looked at Amy and her fellow missionaries, and she was immediately impressed with them. The warmth that was on their faces, the way they spoke, the way they smiled. And she somehow knew, though she was just a young girl, she somehow knew that it had something to do with the God that they served. And as only God can do, he planted a thought in that little girl's mind. And when she wrote about it, she said, this is what she thought. If only I could go to her, Amy Carmichael, the missionary. If only I could go to her, she would have a place in her heart for me. And this living God will cause the day to come that will bring us together, and she will be my mother, and I will be her daughter, and she will teach me to worship him. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. The day came when Star's father was considering the cost of raising another daughter in that Hindu culture. And he thought, well, there's the food, and then there comes a time when the daughter will be married off, and that's very expensive. And maybe the best thing to do would be to let her go where she wants to go, to the mission house. So the father took her to the mission house, and she was there. The father said to Amy, "I want you to know, I might retrieve her at any time. If you do anything here that I don't like, I'll come back and take her away." And Amy said, "Okay." And time after time, the father would come to visit. And when it came time to go, he would hold out his hand for Star. And Star would kind of stiffly stay. He'd put his hand down and walk away. And you never knew how it was going to go. Star ended up staying at the mission house all of her life. Star had a sister, a little sister named Mimosa. Mimosa never saw Amy at the well like Star did. But one day when Father came to visit with Star, Mimosa came along, just a little girl. And she's tripping along by her father's side, and she walks into the mission house. And they're only there in the mission house for a half hour or an hour, not very long. And what could this little girl possibly pick up in 1 hour? Because nobody's even really talking to her. They're talking about other things, and in a way, Mimosa is just eavesdropping. But she sees something in that mission house. And when it comes time to go, she doesn't want to go. And her father goes to take her away. And she said, "Please, Father, let me stay. If only for a little while, that I may understand only a very little bit." And he said, "I've already been shamed to have one of my daughters want to live here. And I'm not going to be shamed again." And she burst out into tears. She just wanted to stay. And as Father is leading her down the path, Amy Carmichael and her colleagues are watching this little girl just crying. And she's so brave, she wipes the tears away from her eyes. And she looks back at the missionaries in the mission house. And she forces a smile. I mean, she's so upset. But she wants them to know, "I love you." And she's forcing a smile through her glistening eyes. It's like, what could possibly happen? What could possibly happen in a little girl's heart that make her want to do that? I mean, what could possibly happen? When Jesus was telling his story, he said, sometimes a guy comes along in a field and he finds a pearl of great price. And when once he's seen it, he just sells everything he has to get the pearl. And she wanted to stay, but Dad wasn't having it. So back home, she had to go. And in that conversation that took place at the mission house, she should never have heard anything about Jesus. His name probably didn't come up. Certainly not his crucifixion, his resurrection. She shouldn't hear anything about that. But she saw something there that just impacted her. It was magic. She came home the next day, and every day the little girls have to go to the basket of ashes, put their hand in the ashes and smear the ashes on their forehead. And this is the sacred ashes of Shiva, the god that was worshipped in her part of India. And she told her mother, "No, she's just a little girl. I don't want the ashes." And mother will let it slide. But then the next day, "I don't want the ashes." And the next day, "I don't want the ashes." And all the neighbors said, "You have to let the stick dance." That was their description of a beating with a stick. If she's not going to do this, you have to beat her. And so this little girl is being beaten, and she's digging in, and she's not going to worship Shiva anymore. She only wants to worship the true God, whom she barely knows. And her parents go through this cycle of toleration and beating. For the most part, she's locked away in her little house, and she's not allowed to go anywhere. She has no Christian friends. She has no Christian teachers. She has no Christian Bible. She has no way to read a Bible. She doesn't read. She has no Christian anything. But that's the way it is. And the months turn into years. And she still remembers the God of the mission house and what those people were like. And then time comes when her dad dies. And that really shakes her. I mean, death is death. And then a short time after that, she's married. The marriage was to a young man who claimed to have a lot of money, but in reality, he was in great debt. And soon he had nothing to use to provide for his family. And now there's a new baby. Mimosa is a mom. And the husband won't work because he's from the caste that doesn't work. And so it falls on her to go out to the fields and work. She takes her little baby in swaddling clothes and ties, makes a little hammock and ties him to a branch and goes out there and works like a man, works like a poor person, works very hard. And then another baby comes along and it's rainy season. Well, you can't take the baby outside all day from, it is about 8 in the morning till 6 in the evening. You can't take a baby outside. The husband, he is off traveling. He's a ne'er-do-well, and he has relatives, so he goes and he visits, and it falls on her to make the family work, but she can't take the babies now. So her firstborn child is 2.5 years old, and she leaves the 2.5-year-old in charge of the baby all day, and she hates it. She hates it, but what can she do? I mean, there is no help besides that. She doesn't worship the gods of the Hindus, and so no neighbors will help her. So she tells her little 2.5-year-old boy, the baby is here on our little hammock. When he cries, push him, rock him. Here's his little food. Try to give him food if you can. See you at supper time. And off she goes. She lives like that. Husband comes and goes. He never takes responsibility. It falls on her to work in the fields. And then a third baby comes. And she's really sick. Very sick. There were times when her baby was hanging out there on the branch while she was working, and she just talked to the Lord, the God she hardly knew, the God that was there in the mission house. She doesn't know who he is, really. And she would pray like this: oh God, my husband has deceived me. My brother-in-law has deceived me. Even my mother has deceived me. But you will not deceive me. Yes, they have all deceived me. But I am not offended in you. You will not deceive me. And in India, they have this custom of taking their apron and holding it up as a gesture of receiving. And when she prayed, she held her apron up like, Lord, you just have to take care of me. Well, the third baby comes along and she's very, very sick. She can't go back to work in the fields. I mean, literally, physically, she cannot go out. And she's watching the food supply deplete. And then one of the relatives who owned one of the fields where she worked came and wanted her to get back to work, you know. And she said, I just can't. And he saw that they didn't have any food. And she's been praying, Lord, I'm not offended in you. I know you will never deceive me. And this guy, who normally isn't very compassionate, said, well, I can't let this happen. And he went and he got 6 days' supply of food and brought it to her. And for those 6 days, they ate, and that's what saved her life, praying to the God that she hardly knows. And then at another critical time, the Lord sent this. See, no Christians were around her, except there was this one family that was nominally Christian. They pretended that they were Christians. They didn't act much like Christians. But then there was the old lady, and in her day, she was a for real Christian, but now she has dementia. Well, for whatever reason, the lady with dementia comes to visit Mimosa in her home. And she says to Mimosa, the Lord will never leave us or forsake us. He just won't. And then someday, he's going to take his followers to heaven. See, all of this is news. Mimosa doesn't know. I mean, in her heart, she kind of knows that God won't ever forsake her. But she doesn't know about heaven. And this old woman with dementia, she said that. And as people with dementia do, she said it again. And again, until it was like burned into Mimosa's heart. And it was just like a breath of air, a taste of heaven. And then at another critical time, her middle son got dysentery and he died. And for whatever reason, Mimosa said, I am not going to cremate him like the Hindu people do. I want him to have a Christian burial. She barely even knowing that there is any such thing as a Christian burial. And nobody is supportive of this. And nobody understands. And the funeral is just awkward. And she looks up to heaven before she walks away. And she tells the God that she hardly knows, please receive my beautiful little bird. You know, speaking about her middle son. And then Star, who's at the mission house so far away, has just been worried about Mimosa. And so she decides to craft a letter. And it's just all weird because how is she going to get the letter to Mimosa? Who's going to take it? And even if it gets to Mimosa, Mimosa doesn't know how to read. What's going to happen with the letter? Well, the letter does get to Mimosa. Star had written a Bible verse there from Psalm 27. A cousin comes along, reads the letter to Mimosa, and the letter says, "When my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will take me up." And that's just, you can't imagine what that means to someone when the lions are all around. When my father, even if mom and dad abandon me, the Lord will carry me. And she took that letter and she folded it gently and put it in her box with her favorite things. And though she couldn't read the letter, many times when life was overwhelming, she would just hold the letter in her hand and try to remember, what did it say? "When my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will hold me up." And years go by some more, and now Mimosa has been away from Star for 22 years. Star is all concerned for some reason in this 3-month period of time, concerned for her sister. She can't get Mimosa out of her mind. And she's been praying earnestly. And one day, a letter comes from Mimosa to Star at the mission house. And Mimosa had dictated the letter. And the letter says, "My husband was berating my son because he calculated the family money wrongly. And the son protested and said, 'Dad, how can you possibly find fault with me for being a blockhead,' as he was being called, when it's not my fault. I wanted to go to the mission house and learn how to do this, and you won't let me go." And so the father said, "Okay, I'll let you go." And Mimosa says, "This son has been obsessed with going to the mission house for 3 months. And Star says in her heart, "I've been praying for those same 3 months that they could come to the mission house." And so after 22 years, Mimosa and her two older sons show up at the mission house. And Star has nearly died from sickness, even in the good hands of the missionaries, 4 times. So she's had kind of a hard life. And Star is older than Mimosa by 2 years. But when they see Mimosa, she looks much, much older than Star. Like, what kind of a life has brought you to this? But Mimosa was so pleased. And in time, Mimosa learned to read her Bible, learned about the Lord most thoroughly. And then finally, she ended up dying in the mission hospital. And all of her kids and her husband moved into the mission compound. And all became important to the mission, and that's how the story ends. So the question comes, is Mimosa's God, whom she serves, I mean, she just doesn't even hardly know anything. Can he deliver her from the lions that are literally everywhere around her? And the answer is yeah. And so you have these lions around you. And there's this magic. The God who is always near you, if you will follow him, he will rescue you. Say, "Well, what if the lion eats me?" Well, that's the Stephen story, and he still rescues you. But only if you have the right God, and only if you serve him continuously. I'd like you to bow your heads and close your eyes. I just want to give you a moment in your own heart to do business with God. Like, if you haven't been serving him continually as Daniel did, I want you to do business with God and tell him that you will serve him continually. If you've never followed the Lord Jesus, I hope that right now you'll give your heart to him and say, "I will follow you. I believe in you. I'll follow you." And if there's something other than the true God that you've been investing in, that you've been counting on, I hope you'll tell the true God, you're coming back to him, you're leaving this other thing off to the side where it really belongs, or if it's paganism or false and deceptive philosophy, you leave that entirely. So you just have a moment of silence to talk to the Lord about whatever is on your heart.